I nodded too tightly.
Advertising leaflets of some kind littered the back seat. "Just down the road, 6 or 7 miles," Peter said. "I'll tell you when we get close." He got in. "This is against my principles," the man said, rolling away.
"Pardon?"
"Against my principles. Hitchhiking is pretty dangerous, especially for good-looking kids like you. I don't think you should do it."
Peter laughed out loud, startling both the driver and himself.
The man stopped at the end of Lewis's drive, but would not leave without giving him more advice. "Listen, son, you never know who you're going to meet out on these roads. Could be any kind of pervert." He grabbed Peter's arm just as the boy was opening the door. "Promise me you won't do it again. Promise me, son."
"Okay, I promise," Peter said.
"The Lord knows you made that promise."
The man released Peter's arm, and the boy scrambled out of the car.
"Hold on, son, wait up, just a sec."
Peter fidgeted by the side of the car, shifting on his feet, while the man leaned over and picked up one of the leaflets on the back seat.
"This will help you, son. Read it and keep it. It's got an answer in it."
"An answer?"
"That's right. Show it to your friends."
He handed Peter a cheaply printed pamphlet. The Watchtower. The driver picked up speed on the highway. Peter shoved the little magazine in his pocket and turned around to go up Lewis's drive. The drive had been pointed out to him, but he had never seen Lewis's house, never seen more of it than the gray peaks, which could be glimpsed from the highway. As he began to walk up the drive, these peaks disappeared. The drifted snow had melted and the drive shone, catching the sun at 100 mirror-like points. Seeing the top of the house from the road, Peter had never recognized how far the house sat from the highway, how enclosed it was by trees. When he reached the first curve of the drive, he was able partially to see the house between their trunks, and for the first time he began to question what he was doing. He came closer. A smaller extension of the drive curved off to the front of the house, which looked as long as a city block. Faceted windows threw back the light. The major section of the drive trailed around the side of the house and ended at a brick courtyard, flanked by what looked to Peter like stables. He saw only a corner of these. He could not imagine himself entering such an imposing place. It looked like you could wander a week in it without finding your way out. This evidence of Lewis's separateness, his otherness, put all of Peter's plans in doubt. Going in there seemed ominously like going into the silent house on Montgomery Street. Peter walked around to the rear of the building, trying to relate this massive grandeur to what he thought of Lewis. For Peter, who knew nothing of the house's history, it seemed regal. It demanded a different conception of its owner. Still, the rear of the house was better. A door on a brick court, the homely wooden fronts of the stables, this was at a level with which he was more comfortable. He had just noticed the paths leading into the woods when he heard a voice speaking in his mind. "Imagine Lewis in bed with your mother, Peter. Imagine him lying on top of her."
"No," he whispered.
"Imagine how she looks moving under him naked, Peter. Imagine..."
Peter froze, and the voice ceased simultaneously. A car had turned into the drive from the highway. Lewis had come home. Peter thought for a second if he should wait exposed in the courtyard for Lewis to see him as he drove in, and then the car shifted up and was too near the house, and he could not bear to see Lewis while the echo of the voice still hung in his mind, and he ran to the side of the stables and crouched down. His mother's station wagon rolled into the courtyard behind the house. Peter groaned softly and heard laughter whispering along the painted boards of the old stables. He flattened himself out on the snow and looked through the gnarled stalks of a rosebush as his mother got out of the station wagon. Her face was drawn, pale with concentrated feeling, a taut, angry expression he had never seen. As he watched from beside the stables, she leaned back into the car and tapped the horn twice. Then she straightened up, walked around the front of the car, skirted the puddles on the flat red bricks, and went up to the little door in the rear of the house. He thought she would knock, but she dug in her bag for a moment, took out a key, and let herself in. He heard her call Lewis's name. 3. Lewis steered the Morgan around a black pool on the rutted drive which led to the back of the cheese factory. This was a bungalow-sized, square wooden building Otto had built himself in a valley outside Afton, below a range of wooded hills. Dogs yapped in the kennels to the side of the factory. Lewis parked his car just outside the platform that served as Otto's loading bay, jumped up onto the platform, swung open the metal doors, and went into the factory. He inhaled the pervasive odor of curdled milk. "Lewis!" Otto stood in diffuse light on the other side of the little factory, surrounded by white machinery, supervising while cheese was poured into round, flat wooden molds. As each mold was filled, Otto's son Carl took it to the weighing machine, recorded its weight and the mold number, and then stacked it in a corner. Otto said something to Carl and then came across the wooden floor to grasp Lewis's hand.
"How good to see you, my friend. But, Lewis, you look so god-awful tired. You need some of my homemade schnapps."
"And you look busy," Lewis said. "But I'd be grateful for the schnapps."
"Busy? Don't worry about busy. Carl is handling everything now. I should worry about Carl. He is a good cheesemaker. Almost as good as me."
Lewis smiled, and Otto slapped him on the back and lumbered off to his office, a small enclosure near the loading bay. Otto sank down in his ancient chair behind the desk, making the springs creak. Lewis, across the desk from him.
"Now, my friend." Otto bent over and removed a decanter and two thimble glasses from a drawer. "Now we have a good drink to make your cheeks red again."
He tipped liquid from the decanter into the glasses. The liquor burned Lewis's throat, but tasted like a distillation of massed flowers.
"Delicious." "Of course it is delicious. I make it myself. I suppose you brought your gun, Lewis?"
Lewis nodded.
"So, I thought you were the kind of friend who comes into my office and drinks my schnapps and eats my beautiful new cheese."
Otto pushed himself out of his chair and went the short distance to a low refrigerator.
"But all the time thinks only about going out and shooting something."
He placed a block of cheese, veined with wine, down before Lewis and cut off sections with his knife. This was one of the specialty cheeses Otto made to sell under his own name. The wheels of cheddar went to a combine.
"Now, tell me, am I right?"
"You're right."
"I thought so."
"But it is fine, Lewis. I bought a new dog. Very good dog. This dog can see 2-3 miles. Can smell for 10. Pretty soon, I think I give this dog Carl's job."
The whiny cheese was as good as Otto's schnapps.
"Do you think it might be too wet to take a dog out?"
"No, no. Under those big trees, it won't be so wet. You and me, we'll find some animal, maybe even a fox, huh?"
"And you're not afraid of the game warden?"
"No. They run when they see me. They say, 'Ah, here is that crazy old German with a gun yet.'"
Listening to Otto Gruber's buffoonery, sitting in his office with a fresh glass of the powerful brandy and his mouth full of intricate tastes, Lewis thought that Otto represented a kind of alternative chowder society, a less complicated but equally valuable friendship.
"Let's go out and see that dog," he said.
"Let's see the dog, eh?" "Lewis, when you see my new dog, you will go down on your knees and propose marriage to her."
Both men put on their coats and left the office. Outside, Lewis noticed a tall, skinny boy of roughly Peter Barnes's age up on the loading bay. He wore a purple shirt and tight jeans, and he was piling up the heavy moles for pickup. He stared at Lewis for a moment, then ducked his head and smiled. As they walked toward the kennels, Lewis said,
"You hire a new boy?"
"Yes, you saw him? He was the poor boy who found the body of the old lady who kept the horses. She lived near you."
"Rhea Dedham," Lewis said.
When he glanced over his shoulder, the boy was still looking at him, half smiling. Lewis swallowed and turned away.
"Yeah, he was very disturbed, and he could not stand to live near there anymore. He is a very sensitive boy, Lewis. And so he asked me for a job and got a room in Afton. So I give him a broom and let him clean the machinery and stack the cheese. It is good until after Christmas. Then we cannot afford him so much anymore."
Rhea Dedham, Edward, and John. It pursued him even here. Otto let the new dog out of its kennel and was hunkering down beside it, rubbing his hands up and down its coat. It was a hound, lean and gray with muscular shoulders and haunches. The bitch did not yip like the other dogs or leap around with joy to be out of the kennel, but stood attentively beside Otto, looking about with alert blue eyes. Lewis, too, bent to pet it, and the hound accepted his hand and sniffed his boots.
"This is Flossie," Otto said. "What a dog, eh? What a beauty you are, my Flossie. Shall we take you out now for a little while, my Flossie?"
For the first time, the bitch showed animation, tilting its head and swishing its tail. The well-schooled animal, Otto, jug-eared and happy beside it, the nearness of the trees and the pervasive odors of cheese-making, all of this seemed to swing Lewis in an arc away from the blue-jeaned boy behind him and the chowder society which lurked behind the boy, and he said,
"Otto, I want to tell you a story."
"Yeah? Good. Tell me, Lewis."
"I want to tell you about how my wife died."
Otto cocked his head and, for a moment, absurdly resembled the hound kneeling before him.
"Yeah, good,"
he nodded, and reflectively ran a finger around the base of the hound's ears.
"You can tell me when we go up in the woods for an hour or two, eh? I'm glad, Lewis. I'm glad."
Lewis and Otto called what they did when they went out with rifles and a dog coon hunting, and Otto chortled about the possibility of seeing a fox. But it had been at least a year since they had shot anything. The rifles and the dog were chiefly an excuse to go rambling through the long wood which lay above the cheese factory. For Lewis, it was a sportier version of his morning runs. Sometimes they shot off their guns. Sometimes one of the dogs treed something. Lewis might have tried to shoot it, but at least half the time, Otto looked at the banded, angry animal up on the branch of a tree and laughed.
"Come on, Lewis. This one is too pretty. Let's find an ugly one."
Lewis suspected that if they tried anything like that this time, they'd have to clear it with Flossie first. The sleek little animal was wholly businesslike. She did not go after birds or squirrels like half the other dogs,
but padded along in front of them, tilting her head from side to side, her tail switching.
"Flossie is going to make us work," he said.
"Yeah, I paid $200 to look like a fool in front of a dog, eh?"
Once they were up the valley and into the trees, Lewis felt his tension begin to leave him. Otto was showing off the dog, whistling to make it go out on a wide tangent, whistling again to call it back. Now they were moving through thick woods. As Otto had predicted, it was colder and drier up here than in the valley. In exposed territory, melting snow made rivulets, and marshy ground beneath the remaining snow sucked at their boots. But under a curtain of conifers, it was as if the thaw had never come. Lewis lost sight of Otto for 10 minutes at a time, then caught flashes of his red jacket between green fir needles and heard him communicating with the dog. Lewis lifted his Remington to his shoulder and sighted down on a pine cone. The dog switched and skirmished up ahead, looking for a scent. Half an hour later, when she found one, Otto was too tired to follow it. The dog began baying and streaked off to their right. Otto lowered his blunderbuss and said,
"Ah, let it go, Flossie."
The dog whimpered, turned around to stare disbelievingly at the two men. "What are you clowns doing, anyhow?" Then it lowered its tail and walked back. 10 yards off, it sat down and began licking its hindquarters.
"Flossie has given up on us," Otto said. "We are not in her class. Have a little drink."
He offered Lewis a flask.
"I think we need to be warm, hey, Lewis?"
"Can you build a fire around here?"
"Sure I can. I saw a little deadfall back a teeny bit. Lots of dry wood in there. You just scoop a hole in the snow, get your tinder, and presto, fire."
Seeing that the hill came to its rise only 20 yards above them, Lewis climbed up while Otto went back to the deadfall to collect dry wood and tinder. Flossie, no longer interested, watched him stumble upward toward the ridge. He did not expect what he found. They had come farther than he had thought, and below him, down a long forested slope, was a streak of highway. On the other side of the highway, the woods resumed again, but the few cars traveling the highway were a despoilation. They ruined his fragile mood of well-being. And then it was as if Milburn had reached out even here to point at him on the crest of a wooded hill. One of the cars moving rapidly down the highway was Stella Hawthorne's.
"Oh, God," Lewis muttered, watching Stella's Volvo cross through the space directly before him.
It and the woman driving it brought the night and the morning back to him. He might as well have pitched a tent on the square. "Even out in the woods," Milburn whispered behind him. Stella's car traveled up the road. Her turn indicator flashed, and she pulled onto the shoulder. A moment later, another car pulled in beside her. A man got out and went around to Stella's window and rapped until she opened her door. Lewis turned away and went back down the slippery hill to Otto. He had already started a little fire. At the bottom of a hole scooped in the snow, on a bed of stone, a flame licked at tinder. Otto fed it a larger twig, then another, then a handful, and the single flame grew into a dozen. Above this, Otto built a foot-high teepee of sticks.
"Now, Lewis," he said, "warm your hands."
"Ene schnapps left."
Lewis took the flask and joined Otto on a fallen log dusted of its snow. Otto dug in his pockets and withdrew a homemade sausage sliced neatly in half. He gave half to Lewis and bit into his own half. The fire leaped up into the teepee and warmed Lewis's ankles through his boots. He extended his hands and feet and around a bit of sausage said,
"One night, Linda and I went to a dinner in one of the suites of the hotel I owned. Linda didn't live through the night. Otto, I think the same thing that got my wife is after me.
4. Peter stood up beside the stables, crossed the court, and peeked in the kitchen window. Pans on the stove, a round table laid for two. His mother had come for breakfast. He heard her footsteps as she went further into the house, obviously looking for Louis Benedict. What would she do when she found out he wasn't there? Of course, she isn't in danger, he told himself. This isn't her house. She can't be in danger. She'll find out Louis isn't here, and then she'll go back home. But it was too much like the other time. He looking in a window and waiting at a door while another person prowled within an empty house. She'll just go home. He touched the door, expecting it to be locked, but it swung open an inch. This time he would not go in. He was afraid of too much. Only part of it was the possibility of meeting his mother in the house and having to invent an explanation for his being there. But he could do that. He could say that he wanted to talk to Louis about anything. Cornell University, fraternities. He saw Jim Hardy's crushed head sliding down a mottled wall. Peter took his hand off the door and stepped down into the brick court. He took several steps backward, looking up at the rear of the house. It was a fantasy, anyhow. His mother's angry face had made it clear that she would not accept any fairy tales about advice on fraternities. He backed up further, the fortress-like back of Lewis's house seeming for a moment almost to lean over and follow him. A curtain twitched, and Peter was unable to move further. Someone was behind the curtain, someone not his mother. He could see only white fingers holding back the fabric. Peter wanted to run, but his legs would not move. The figure with the white hands was lowering its face to the glass and grinning down at him. It was Jim Hardy. Inside the house, his mother screamed. Peter's legs unlocked, and he ran across the court and through the back door. He went rapidly through the kitchen and found himself in the dining room. Through a wide doorway, he could see living room furniture, light coming in through the front windows. Mom! He ran into the living room. Two leather couches flanked a fireplace. Antique weapons hung on one wall. Mom! Jim Hardy walked into the room, smiling. He showed the palms of his hands, demonstrating to Peter that his intentions were not violent.
Hi, he said.
But the voice was not Jim's. It was not the voice of any human being.
You're dead, Peter said.
It's funny about that, the Hardy thing replied. You don't really feel that way after it happens. You don't even feel pain, Pete. It feels almost good. No, it definitely feels pretty good. And of course there's nothing left to worry about. That's a big plus.
What did you do to my mother?
Oh, she's fine. She's upstairs with her now. You can't go up there. I'm supposed to talk to you. Hi.
Peter looked wildly at the wall of spears and pikes, but it was too far away.
You don't even exist, he shouted, almost crying. They killed you!
He pulled a lamp from a table beside one of the couches.
It's hard to say, Jim said. You can't say I don't exist, because here I am. Did I say hi yet? I'm supposed to say that. Peter
threw the lamp at Hardy Thing's chest as hard as he could. It went on talking for the seconds the lamp was in the air.
Sit down and...
The lamp exploded it into a shower of lights like sparks and crashed into the wall. Peter ran down the length of the living room, almost sobbing with impatience. At the room's other end, he passed through an arch, and his feet skidded on black and white tiles. To his right was the massive front door. To his left, a carpeted staircase. Peter ran up the stairs. When he reached the first landing, he stopped, seeing that the staircase continued. Down at the other end of the gallery-like hall, he could see the foot of another staircase, which evidently led to another area of the house.
"Mom!"
Then he heard a whimpering noise very near. He moved to Lewis's monkey wood door and opened it. His mother made another strangled whimpering noise. Peter ran into the room and stopped. The man from Anna Mostyn's house stood near a large bed that Peter knew must have been Lewis's. Striped pajamas hung from a chair. The man wore the dark glasses and knit cap. His hands were around Christina Barnes's neck.
"Master Barnes," he said, "how you young people get around, and how you poke your charming noses into other people's business. You'll be needing the ferrule, I'm thinking."
"Mom, they're not real," he said. "You can make them disappear."
His mother's eyes protruded and her body moved convulsively.
"You just can't listen to what they say. They get inside your head and make you hypnotized."
"Oh, we had no need to do that," the man said.
Peter moved to the broad shelf beneath the windows and picked up a vase of flowers.
"Boy," the man said.
Peter cocked his arm. His mother's face was turning blue and her tongue protruded. He made a frantic mewing sound in his throat and took aim at the man. Two cold, small hands closed around his wrist. A wave of rotten air, the odor of an animal left dead for days in the sun, went over him.
"That's a good boy," the man said.
Hatpin. 5. Harold Sims got angrily into the car, forcing Stella to move sideways on the seat.
"What's the big idea? What the hell do you mean, acting like this?"
Stella took a pack of cigarettes from her bag, lit one, and then silently offered the pack to Harold.
"I said, what's the big idea? I had to drive 25 miles to get here."
He pushed the cigarettes away.
"It was your idea to meet, I believe. At least, that is what you said on the telephone." "I meant at your house, goddammit. You knew that."
"And then I specified here. You did not have to come."
"But I wanted to see you."
"Then what is the difference to you whether we meet here or in Milburn? You can say what you want to say here." Sims punched the dashboard.
"Damn you! I'm under stress. A great deal of stress. I don't need problems from you. What's the point of meeting out here on this godforsaken part of the highway?"
Stella looked around them.
"Oh, I think it's really a rather pretty spot, don't you? It's quite a beautiful spot. But to answer your question, the point, of course, is that I did not want you to come to my house."
He said,
"You don't want me to come to your house?"
And for a moment looked so stupid that Stella knew she was an enigma to him. Men to whom you were an enigma were thoroughly useless.
"No," she said gently, "I did not." "Well, Jesus, we could have met in a bar somewhere or in a restaurant, or you could have come to Binghamton. I wanted to see you alone." "Okay, I give up."
And he lifted his hands as if literally giving something away.
"I suppose you're not even interested in what my problem is." "Harold," she said, "you've been telling me all about your problems for months now, and I have listened with every appearance of interest."
Abruptly, he exhaled loudly, then put a hand over hers and said,
"Will you leave with me? I want you to go away with me." "That's not possible,"
She patted his hand, then lifted the hand off hers.
"Nothing like that is going to happen, Harold. Come away with me next year. That gives us plenty of time to break the news to Ricky."
He squeezed her hand again.
"Besides being impertinent, you are being foolish. You are 46, I am 60, and you have a job."
Stella felt almost as though she were speaking to one of her children. This time she very firmly removed his hand and placed it on the steering wheel.
"Oh, hell," he moaned. "Oh, hell. Oh, goddammit. I only have a job until the end of the year. The department isn't recommending me for promotion, and that means I have to go. Holtz broke the news to me today. He said he was sorry to do it, but that he was trying to move the department in a new direction, and I wasn't cooperating. Also, I haven't published enough. Well, I haven't published anything in 2 years, but that isn't my fault, you know. I did 3 articles, and every other anthropologist in the country got published."
"I have heard all this before," Stella interrupted. She stubbed out her cigarette.
"Yeah, but now it's really important. The new guys in the department have just aced me out. Ledbetter got a grant to live on an Indian reservation next term, and a contract with Princeton University Press. And Johnson's got a book coming out next fall, and I get the axe."
What he was saying finally reached Stella through her impatience with the sound of his voice.
"Do you mean to say, Harold, that you invited me to run away with you when you don't even have a job?"
"I want you with me."
"Where did you plan to go?"
"I don't know, maybe California."
"Oh, Harold, you are being insufferably banal," she exploded.
"Do you want to live in a trailer park? Eat taco burgers? Instead of moaning to me, you ought to be writing letters and trying to find a new job. And why should you think that I would enjoy sharing your poverty? I was your mistress, not your wife."
At the last second, she restrained herself from adding, "Thank God." In a muffled voice, Harold said,
"I need you."
"This is ridiculous."
I do need you."
She saw that he was working himself up to the point of tears.
"Now you are being not only banal, but self-pitying. You really are a very self-pitying man, Harold. It took me a long time to see it, but lately when I have thought of you, I have seen you with a big placard around your neck which reads, 'Deserving Case.' Admit it, Harold. Things have not been very satisfactory between us lately."
"Well, if I disgust you so much, why do you go on seeing me?"
"You did not have much competition. And, in fact, I do not intend to go on seeing you. In any case, you will be far too busy applying for jobs to cater to my whims, and I will be too busy looking after my husband to listen to your complaints."
"Your husband?"
Sim said, now really stunned.
"Yes. He is far more important to me than you, and at this moment he needs me much more. So I am afraid that this is it. I will not see you any more."
"That dried-up little... that old clothes horse? He can't be..."
"Watch out," Stella warned.
"He's so insignificant," Sims wailed. "You've been making a fool of him for years."
"All right. He is anything but dried up, and I will not listen to you insult him. If I have had an experimental approach to men during my life, Ricky has accommodated himself to it, which I dare say is more than you would be capable of doing. and if I have made a fool of anyone, it is myself. I think it is time I retired into respectability. And if you cannot see that Ricky has 4 or 5 times your own significance, then you are deluding yourself.
Jesus, you can really be a bitch, Harold said, his little eyes as wide as they could get.
She smiled.
You're the most terrifying, ruthless creature I've ever known, as Melvin Douglas said to Joan Crawford. I cannot remember the name of the movie, but Ricky is very fond of the line. Why don't you call him up and ask him the name of the picture?
God! When I think of the man, you must have turned into dog shit.
Few of them made the transformation so successfully.
You bitch!
Harold's mouth was thinning dangerously.
You know, like all intensely self-pitying men, you really are very crude, Harold. Would you please get out of my car?
You're angry, he said in disbelief. I lose my job and you just dumped on me, and you're angry.
Yes, I am. Please get out, Harold. Go back to your little heaven of self-regard.
I could get out right now.
He leaned forward.
Or I could force you to see reason by making you do what you enjoy so much.
I see. You're threatening to rape me, are you, Harold?
It's more than a threat.
It's promise, is it?
She asked, seeing real brutishness in him for the first time.
Well, before you start slobbering over me, I'll make you a promise, too.
Stella lifted a hand to the underside of her lapel and pulled out a long hat pin. She had carried it with her for years now, ever since a man in Schenectady had followed her all day through shops. She held the hat pin out before her.
If you make one move toward me, I promise you I'll plant this thing in your neck.
Then she smiled, and it was the smile that did it. He scrambled out of the seat as if given an electric shock and slammed the door behind him. Stella reversed the car to the restraining fence, changed gears, and shot out across the oncoming traffic.
God damn it!
He pounded a fist into the palm of the other hand.
I hope you have an accident!
Sims picked up a stone from the gravelly shoulder and threw it across the highway. Then he stood for a moment, breathing heavily.
Jesus! What a bitch!
He ran his fingers through his cropped hair. He was far too angry to drive all the way back to the university. Sims looked at the forest, which began down the slope, saw the puddles of icy water between the trees, and then looked across the 4 lanes of road to the dry, higher ground. Story 6.
We'd just had a fight, Lewis said. We didn't have many, and when we had one, I was usually wrong. This time it was because I fired one of the maids. She was just a girl from the country around Malaga. I can't even remember her name anymore. But she was a crank, or so I thought.
He cleared his throat and leaned toward the fire.
The reason was that she was all caught up in the occult. She believed in magic, evil spirits, Spanish peasant spiritualism. That didn't bother me enough to fire her, even though she spooked some of the help by seeing omens and everything. Birds on the lawn, unexpected rain, a broken glass, all omens. The reason I fired her was that she refused to clean one of the rooms.
It is a pretty damn good reason, Otto said.
I thought so, too. But Linda thought I was being hard on the girl. She'd never refused to clean the room before. The girl was upset by the guests. Said they were bad or something. It's crazy.
Lewis took another slug of the brandy, and Otto added a branch to the fire. Flossie came nearer and lay with her hindquarters close to the flames.
"Were these guests Spanish, Lewis?"
"Americans. A woman from San Francisco named Florence de Pizer, and a little girl, her niece, Alice Montgomery. Cute little girl, about 10. And Mrs. de Pizer had a maid who traveled with her, a Mexican-American woman named Rosita. They stayed in a big suite at the top of the hotel. Really, Otto, you couldn't imagine people less spooky than those three. Of course, Rosita could have kept the suite clean, and probably did. But it was our girl's job to go in there once a day, and she refused, so I fired her. Linda wanted me to change the schedule around and let one of the other girls do it." Lewis stared into the fire. "People heard us fighting about it, and that was rare, too. We were out in the Rose Garden, and I guess I yelled. I thought it was a matter of principle. So did Linda. Of course, I was stupid. I should have switched the schedule like Linda wanted. But I was too stubborn. In a day or two, she would have swung me around to her point of view. But she didn't live long enough." Lewis spit off a piece of the sausage, and for a time chewed silently without tasting. "Mrs. de Pizer invited us to dinner in the suite that same night. Most nights we ate by ourselves and stayed out of people's way. But now and then a guest would invite us to join them for lunch or dinner. I thought Mrs. de Pizer was extending herself to be gracious, and I accepted for us. I should not have gone. I was very tired, exhausted. I'd been working hard all day. Besides arguing with Linda, I had helped load 200 cases of wine into the storeroom in the morning, and then I played obligation games in a tennis tournament all afternoon, two doubles matches. What I really needed was a quick snack and then bed. But we went up to the suite around 9. Mrs. de Pizer gave us drinks, and then we had arranged with the waiter that the meal was to be brought up around 9:45. Rosita would serve it, and the waiter could go back to the dining room. Well, I had one drink and felt woozy. Florence de Pizer gave me another, and all I was fit for was trying to make conversation with Alice. She was a lovely little girl, but she never spoke unless you asked her a question. She was suffocated by good manners, and so passive that you thought she was simple-minded. I gathered that her parents had shunted her off onto her aunt for the summer. Later, I wondered if my drink had been drugged. I began to feel odd, not sick or drunk exactly, but dissociated, like I was floating above myself. But Florence de Pizer, who had given us a jaunt on her yacht, well, it was just impossible. Linda noticed that I wasn't feeling well, but Mrs. de Pizer pooh-poohed her, and, of course, I said I felt fine. We sat down to eat. I managed to get down a few bites, but I did feel very light-headed. Alice said nothing during the meal, but looked at me shyly from time to time, smiling as if I were an unusual treat. That was not how I felt. In fact, it may have been only alcohol on top of weariness. My senses were screwy, my fingers felt numb in my jaw, and the colors in the room seemed paler than I knew they were. I couldn't taste the food at all.
After dinner, her aunt sent Alice to bed. Rosita served cognac, which I didn't touch. I was able to talk, I know, and I may have seemed normal to anyone but Linda, but all I wanted to do was get to bed. The suite, large as it was, seemed to tighten down over me, over the three of us at the table. Mrs. DePizer kept us there, talking. Rosita melted away. Then the child called me from her room. I could hear her voice saying, "Mr. Benedict, Mr. Benedict," over and over again, very softly. Mrs. DePizer said, "Would you mind? She likes you very much." "Sure," I said, "I'd be happy to say goodnight to the girl," but Linda stood up before I could and said, "Darling, you're too tired to move. Let me go." "No," said Mrs. DePizer, "the child wants him." But it was too late. Linda was already going toward the girl's bedroom. And then it was too late for everything. Linda went into the bedroom, and a second later I knew something was horribly wrong, because there wasn't any noise. I had heard the child half-whispering when she called to me, and I should have heard Linda speaking to her. It was the loudest silence of my life. I was aware, fuzzy as I was, of Mrs. DePizer staring at me. That silence ticked on. I stood up and began to go toward the bedroom. Linda began to shriek before I got halfway. They were terrible shrieks, so piercing. Lewis shook his head. I banged open the door and burst in, just as I heard the noise of breaking glass. Linda was frozen in the window, glass showering all over. Then she was gone. I was too shocked and terrified even to call out. For a second, I couldn't move. I looked at the girl, Alice. She was standing on her bed with her back flattened against the wall. For a second, for less than a second, I thought she was smirking at me. I ran to the window. Alice started sobbing behind me. It was much too late to help Linda, of course. She was lying dead way down on the patio. A little crowd of people who had come out of the dining room for the evening air stood around her body. Some of them looked up and saw me leaning out of the broken window. A woman from Yorkshire screamed when she saw me.
"She thought you had pushed her," Otto said.
"Yes. She made a lot of trouble for me with the police. I could have spent the rest of my life in a Spanish jail."
"Louis, couldn't this Mrs. DePizer and the little girl explain what really happened?"
"They checked out. They were booked for another week, but while I was making statements to the police, they packed up and left."
"But didn't the police try to find them?"
"I don't know. I never found them again. And I'll tell you a funny thing, Otto. The story has a joke ending. When she checked out, Mrs. DePizer paid with an American Express card. She made a little speech to the desk clerk, too, said she was sorry to go, that she wished she could do something to help me, but that it was impossible, after the shock she and Alice had had, for them to stay on. A month later, we heard from American Express that the card was invalid. The real Mrs. DePizer was dead, and the company could not honor any debts on her account." Lewis actually laughed. One of the sticks in the fire tumbled down onto the coals, showering sparks out over the snow. "She stiffed me," he said, and laughed again. "Well, what do you think of that story?"
"I think it is a very American sort of story," Otto said. "You must have asked the child what happened. At least, what made her stand up on the bed?"
Did I? I grabbed her and shook her, but she just cried. Then I carried her over to her aunt and got downstairs as fast as I could. I never had another chance to talk to her. Otto, why did you say it was an American sort of story?
Because, my good friend, everyone in your story is haunted. Even the credit card was haunted. Most of all, the teller. And that, my friend, is echt Amerikanisch.
Well, I don't know, said Lewis. Look, Otto, I sort of feel like going off by myself for a little while. I'll just wander around for a few minutes. Do you mind?
Are you going to take your fancy rifle?
No, I'm not going to kill anything.
Take poor Flossie along.
Fine. Come on, Flossie. The dog jumped up, all alertness again, and Lewis, who was now really unable to sit still or to pretend in any way that he was unaffected by the feelings which had sprung out at him from his memories, walked off into the woods. Witness 7. Peter Barnes dropped the vase, half nauseated by the foul smell which had swept over him. He heard a high-pitched giggling. His wrist was already cold where the unseen boy gripped him. Already knowing what he would see, he turned around to see it. The boy who had been sitting on the gravestone was holding onto his wrist with both hands, looking up at Peter's face with the same idiot mirth. His eyes were blank gold. Peter chopped at him with his free hand, expecting that the scrawny, reeking kid would blow apart like the Jim Hardy thing downstairs. Instead, the boy ducked the blow and kicked at his ankles with a bony foot, which hit him like a sledgehammer. The kick dumped Peter on the ground.
"Make him look, brat," the man said.
The boy nipped behind Peter, clamped his head between two ice-hard hands, and turned him around by force. The terrible foulness intensified. Peter realized that the boy's head was just behind his own and screamed,
"Get away from me!"
But the hands on his head increased their pressure. It felt as though the sides of his skull were being pushed together.
"Let me go!"
he yelled. And this time he did fear that the boy would crush his skull. His mother's eyes were closed. Her tongue stuck out further.
"You killed her," he said.
"Oh, she is not dead yet," the man said. "She is merely unconscious. We need her to be alive, don't we, Fanny?" Peter heard horrible squeals from behind him.
"You strangled her," he said.
The pressure of the boy's hands lessened to its original level, enough to hold him as if in a clamp, but not to death, the man said, giving a mock pedantic inflection to the words. "I may have crushed her poor little windpipe a little, and the poor darling probably has a very sore throat. But she does have a pretty neck, doesn't she, Peter?" He dropped one hand and held Christina Barnes up with the other, as if she weighed no more than a cat. The exposed portion of her neck wore large purple bruises.
"You hurt her,"
Peter said.
"I am afraid that I did. I only wish that I could perform the same service to you. But our benefactor, the charming woman whose house you broke into with your friend, has decided that she wants you for herself. At the moment she is occupied with more urgent business. But great treats are in store for you, Master Barnes, and for your older friends. By that time, neither you nor they will know up from down. You will not know if you're reaping or sowing. Isn't that right, idiot brother?"
The boy gripped Peter's head painfully tightly and made a whinnying noise.
"What are you?" Peter said.
"I am you, Peter,"
the man said. He was still holding his mother up with one hand. Isn't that a nice, simple answer? Of course, it is not the only answer. A man named Harold Sims, who knows your older friends, would undoubtedly say that I am a Manitou. Mr. Donald Wanderley has been told that my name is Gregory Benton, and that I am a resident of the city of New Orleans. Of course, I once spent several entertaining months in New Orleans, but I can't be said to be from there. I was born with the name Gregory Bate, and that was how I was known until my death in the year 1929. Fortunately, I had entered into an agreement with a charming woman known as Florence DePizer, which spared me the usual indignities attendant upon death, which I am afraid I rather feared. And what do you fear, Peter? Do you believe in vampires? In werewolves? The resonant voice had been unreeling in Peter's mind, lulling and soothing him, and it was a moment before he realized that he had been asked a direct question. No, he whispered, and then, liar, went through his mind. And the man holding his mother by the throat altered, and Peter knew in every cell that what he was looking at was not merely a wolf, but a supernatural being in wolf form, whose only purpose was to kill, to create terror and chaos, and to take life as savagely as possible. Saw that pain and death were the only poles of its being. He saw that this being had nothing in it that was human, and that it only dressed in the body it had once owned. He saw, too, now that it was letting him see deeply into it, that this pure destructiveness was not its own master, any more than a dog is. Another mind owned and directed it, as surely as the creature owned the dreadful purity of its evil. All of this Peter saw in a second, and the next second brought an even worse recognition, that in all of this blackness lived a morally fatal glamour.
I don't,
he uttered, trembling. Oh, but you do, the werewolf said, and put his dark glasses back on. I saw perfectly well that you do. I could have been a vampire just as easily. That is even more beautiful, and perhaps even closer to the truth.
What are you?
Peter asked again. Well, you could call me Dr. Rabbit Foot, the creature said. Or you could call me a night watcher. Peter blinked. Now I am afraid we must leave you. Our benefactor will arrange another meeting with you and your friends in due time. But before we take our leave, we must satisfy our hunger. It smiled. Its teeth were gleamingly white. Hold him very still, it commanded, and the hands pushed with terrible force on the sides of Peter's head. He began to cry. Still smiling, the creature pulled Christina Barnes closer to him, and dipping its head to her neck, slid its mouth over her skin. Peter tried to leap forward, but the frozen hands held him back. The creature began to eat. Peter tried to scream, and the dead child holding him moved its hands to cover his mouth. It pressed Peter's head against his chest. The smell of putrefaction, his terror and despair, the horror of being clasped against the revolting body, and the greater horror of what was happening to his mother. He blacked out. When he awakened, he was alone. The stench of corruption still hung in the room. Peter moaned and pushed himself up into a kneeling position. The vase he had dropped lay on its side near him. Flowers, still brilliant, were strewn out across a puddle on the carpet. He raised his hands to his face
and caught on them the reek of the dead boy who had held him. He gagged. The awful smell must have covered his mouth, too, rubbed off the boy's hand. It was as though his mouth and cheek were covered with decay. Peter ran out of the bedroom and down the hall until he found a bathroom. Then he turned on the hot water and scrubbed his face and hands over and over, working up the lather and rinsing it off, then taking the soap again and working it between his palms. He was sobbing. His mother was dead. She had come to see Lewis, and they had killed her. They had done to her what they did to animals. They were dead creatures that lived like vampires on blood. But they were not vampires, nor were they werewolves. They could just make you think they were. They had sold themselves long ago to whatever owned them. Peter remembered green light leaking from beneath a door and nearly vomited into the sink. She owned them. They were night watchers, night things. He smeared Lewis's soap over his mouth, rubbing and rubbing to rid himself of the smell of Fenny's hands. Peter remembered Jim Hardy, seated at the bar in a seedy country tavern, asking him if he would like to see all of Milburn go up in flames, and knew that unless he could be stronger, braver, and smarter than Jim, that what would happen to Milburn would be worse than that. The Night Watchers would systematically ruin the town, make it a ghost town, and leave behind only the stench of death. "Because that's all they want," he said to himself, remembering Gregory Bates' naked face. "All they want is to destroy." He saw Jim Hardy's taut face, the face of Jim drunk and hurling himself into a wild scheme, the face of Sonny Vanuti leaning toward him with her pop eyes, of his mother as she left the station wagon on the brick court, and, chillingly, of the actress at the party last year looking at him with a smiling mouth and expressionless eyes. He dropped Lewis's towel on the bathroom floor. "They've been here before." There was only one person who could help him, who might not think he was lying or crazy. He had to get back to town and see the writer who was staying in the hotel. The loss of his mother went through him once again, shaking tears from him, but he did not have time to cry now. He went out into the hall and past the heavy door.
"Oh, Mom," he said. "I'll stop them. I'll get them. I'll—"
But the words were hollow, just a boy's defiance.
"They want you to think that."
Peter did not look back at the house as he ran down the drive, but he felt it back there, watching him and mocking his puny intentions, as if it knew that his freedom was only that of a dog on a leash. At any second he could be pulled back, his neck bruised, his wind cut off. He saw why when he reached the end of Lewis's drive. A car was parked on the verge of the highway, and the Jehovah's Witness who had given him a lift was inside it, looking at him. He blinked his lights at Peter, glowing eyes.
"Come along," the man called. "Just come along, son."
Peter ran out into the traffic. An oncoming car squealed around him. Another car skidded to a stop. Half a dozen horns cried out. He reached the median and ran across the empty other half of the highway. He could still hear the witness calling to him.
"Come back! It's no good!"
Peter disappeared into the underbrush on the far side of the highway. Among the noises and confusions of traffic, he clearly heard the witness starting up his car to track him back to town. 8. 5 minutes after Lewis left Otto's fire, he began to feel tired. His back ached from all the shoveling he had done the day before. His legs threatened to give out. The hound